Christ is risen. Hallelujah. You passed. You passed the Easter test. You did precisely what you were supposed to do. The guy in the white robe says, Christ is risen, and you appropriately responded with,
He is risen indeed. Hallelujah.
Gold star. Which is more than can be said for those first Easter celebrants. They didn't have Christ is risen, He is risen indeed, back then. But certainly they did not respond as they were supposed to on that first Easter greeting. The Easter angel in his white robe proclaims, Jesus is not here. Do not be afraid. What happens? Well, they flunked. They're bewildered. They're confused. They're bemused. They're afraid. They run away, scared. The Easter women get an F. They're not the only ones. But they showed up respecting death with their spices and their grief to keep a dead guy from stinking. The angel cries out, Do not be afraid. You seek Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell the disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he said. And they fled, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. F minus. It's kind of an odd way to end the gospel with Mark. His last words, for they were afraid. Hey, we're supposed to... It's Easter, end the story with joy and hope and music and eagerness and anticipation and encouragement, excitement. Instead, Mark lays his pen down and decides to end his Jesus story with, and they were afraid. Imagine it had something to do with the stone and the empty tomb. And the angel, probably a little shocked, I'm pretty sure Mark wants to show us something deeper. The fear that he ends the gospel with, the unexpectedness of it all, is that if he is arisen, then nothing, nothing can stay the same. And for people then and now, for people who are real comfortable with the status quo, who are comfortable living life, the Son of God, risen, is terrifying. In a world where a guy who was crucified and breathes again, well, that's a world where I no longer am allowed to hate my enemies. I'm to love them. In a world where the guy dies with forgiveness on his lips, well, that's a world where I am no longer allowed to keep track of wrongs. God, in his life, refused every boundary. He ate with publicans and with prostitutes and priests. And when he dies and lives again, well, then our boundaries and divisions are on the way out, and that can be scary. We might as well just run away. But But perhaps scariest of all, most frightening of all, is the love that refuses to even let death put an end to his great love. It's frightening enough to be loved by another human being. It shows us that we might begin to feel out of control. It might change us in ways that we are not comfortable with. But when the love is the love of an eternal God, that is love that can change us, and it's scary. Walter Wangerin, a professor at Valparaiso University, author, father, teacher, he writes in one of his stories, Matthew 7, 8, 9, story about his son, Matthew, when he's 7 years old, 8 years old, and 9 years old. And he discovers his little boy is a thief. He walks in one night, and Matthew, on his bedroom floor, has 60 comic books laid out on the floor that he stole from the library. But the kid has no conscience. He doesn't even care. Dad thinks that he has to break this behavior, and he makes the librarian out to be this cruel, cruel person. And so he marches Matthew up to the library and stands him in front of this terrifying librarian. And he is so terrified that he doesn't steal another comic book until he's 8. The next year, they're in St. Louis. Sure enough, he walks in on his son, and he finds his son's bottom bedroom dresser drawer with a comic book sticking out. He opens the drawer, and it's stuffed full of comic books that he stole from the convenience store. And this father now knows he has to break this kleptomaniac behavior of his son. And so he goes outside and he builds a fire, and one by one he takes those comic books and he throws it into this inferno, and he terrifies his son that that's what's going to happen to your soul if you steal another comic book. And his son stands there and he's terrified, and it works. He does not steal another comic book until he's 9. Well, his father catches him again when he's 9, and now he knows that he has to do something that he's never done before. He's unaccustomed to doing, and he decides to spank his son. And so he takes his trembling son into the room, and he spanks him good 5 times. The son does not make a sound. He does not cry. He doesn't shed a tear. The dad just walks out silently out of the room. He goes off and wonders, how could this have gone so out of control? And he weeps. Well, the spanking worked. The comic book stealing had stopped. Matthew did not steal another book. Seriously, he did not, no more. Not until he was 10. He's done. Years later, they're reminiscing, Matthew and his mother, about old times, and the comic book story came up, and he said to his mother, you know, Mom, why I stopped stealing comic books? She said, of course I know why you stopped stealing comic books. Your father spanked you. No, Mom, I did not stop stealing comic books because Dad spanked me. I stopped stealing comic books because Dad cried. And then Wangren goes on to write about hereafter, let the accuser, every accuser of my son, reckon with the mercy of God and fall into a heap and fail. For love accomplished what demands could not, and tears more powerful than Sinai. Even the prince of accusers should bring no charge against my son, that the final judge should not dismiss. Satan, you are defeated. My God has loved my Matthew. I love that story. I love that story because it's a parable of God's love for us. It's a parable of how his resurrected love changes us. Nothing in our lives, nothing in our world, nothing in our marriages, nothing in our relationships will ever change as long as we have some other authority, some other God telling us do this or do that or you will be damned. We don't have a God like that. Instead, we have a God who cries. We have a God whose heart breaks for us. You have a God whose heart breaks for you, who on the cross, his heart is broken. His body is broken for you. And with dying words screaming, I love you. And that you may know that nothing may undo that love. On the third day, he comes through death. And he pops out on the other side with a voice, Satan, you are defeated. God has loved my children. My love wins. That's scary love because it is a love that can change us. It's a love that does change us. Our world, our marriages, and refuses to leave you alone. It's an empty tomb, and we stand in front of an empty tomb. It's important on a day like today when we've got our flowers and we've got our beautiful music and we've got our new shoes and our new clothes. And then we go back to our same dismal garbage. God did not die so you can go back to your same dismal garbage. God did not rise again so that you can go back to your same dismal garbage. He died and rose to make you new. He died to make you forgiven. He died to make you unafraid of death. He rose so instead of moping through life, shaped by the status quo, you can run through life with the certainty of life eternal. You know, the grave and the empty tomb might seem a little scary. But once you get used to it, it's pretty awesome. Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.
Hallelujah. A plus.